For most people in the world, these notions that history is somehow encoded with meaning, that we know in advance that things will improve instead of degenerate, are even today considered nothing short of ridiculous. In the West, too, the idea of progress continues to be debated. For instance, there is an ongoing argument about whether progress is comprehensive, i.e., whether progress involves only material gains or also moral gains. But in some form, the faith in progress is very widespread in the West, and the belief in it holds because it is supported by the contemporary experience of the people of the West. Where then did the Western belief in progress come from? From Christianity. It is Christianity that introduced the idea of a divine plan for man and the world. In this view, history was not one meaningless event after another. It represented the fulfillment of a storyline that began with the fall, but would end in triumph with the second coming of Christ. The Christian narrative is one of creation, incarnation, and last judgment. As J.B. Burry points out in The Idea of Progress, doctrine by itself does not generate the notion of progress. For this to happen, it must be secularized. This is done by keeping the concept of development, but introducing man as its author and instrument. Human beings, building upon the discoveries of the past and of each other, will assure the continual advance of knowledge and its application to the betterment of the human condition. This is the idea that we recognize as progress. The idea of progress is a secular expression of the idea of providence. I think I have given some indication of why science is a Western institution, and of how it developed in the West. Now let me suggest why democracy and capitalism, too, are Western. Democracy is based on a broad human aspiration, the aspiration to be heard and to participate in decision-making. Other cultures have accommodated this aspiration. We can imagine a village leader in Asia or Africa soliciting input from his people as he makes an important decision. Tribal participation in this sense is universal. But democracy, by which I mean free elections and peaceful transitions of power and representative government and separation of powers and checks and balances, is a Western idea. The ancient Greeks had a version of democracy. Theirs was direct rather than representative democracy. The people made decisions themselves rather than electing others to do so on their behalf. Moreover, Greek democracy was a kind of aristocracy because it excluded slaves, women, and resident aliens and thus limited the franchise to a very small percentage of the population. It is the modern West that first invented the notion of representative democracy based on an expansion of the franchise and on the consent of the governed. Capitalism, too, is based on a universal human impulse, the impulse to barter and trade. All societies have engaged in some form of exchange. Even the use of money is not Western in origin. But capitalism, by which I mean property rights and contracts and courts to enforce them and free trade, in short, the whole ensemble of arrangements that Adam Smith described in The Wealth of Nations, is a Western institution. Modern capitalism also requires limited liability corporations, stock exchanges, patents, insurance, double entry bookkeeping, and legal limits on state seizure of assets. This framework also developed in the West. Moreover, there is a psychology that is critical to capitalist success. Capitalism is based on the belief that the calling of the merchant or entrepreneur is a worthwhile one. In most societies, merchants and entrepreneurs have been regarded as low-life scum. And for centuries, this prejudice was also held in the West. How this prejudice was overcome is a story that I must reserve for the next chapter. Here I am content to argue that it is the interaction between the three Western institutions of science, democracy, and capitalism that has produced the great wealth and strength and success of Western civilization. An example of this interaction, one of the most powerful engines of that success, technology, arises out of the marriage between science and capitalism. Science provides the knowledge that leads to invention, and capitalism supplies the mechanism by which the invention is transmitted to the larger society, as well as the economic incentive for inventors to continue to make new things. Now we can understand better why the West was able, between the 16th century and the 19th century, to subdue the rest of the world and bend it to its will. Indian elephants and Zulu spears were no match for British jeeps and rifles. Colonialism and imperialism are not the cause of the West's success, they are the result of that success. The wealth and military power of the European nations made them arrogant and stimulated their appetite for global conquest. Thus the British, the Dutch, and the French went abroad in search of countries to subdue and rule. These colonial possessions added to the prestige and to a lesser degree to the wealth of Europe. But the primary cause of Western affluence and power is internal, the institutions of science, democracy, and capitalism acting in concert. Consequently, it is simply wrong to maintain that the rest of the world is poor because the West is rich, or that the West grew rich off stolen goods from Africa, Asia, and Latin America, because the West created its own wealth, and still does. The doctrine of oppression ignores this fact and continues to fuel anti-Western resentment around the world and within the nations of the West. I think we can now conclude that the doctrine is false, and the animus that is based on it is misplaced. Chapter 3. Becoming American. Why the American Idea is Unique. The idea of right is simply that of virtue introduced into the political world. Alexis de Tocqueville. 100 years ago, Western civilization enjoyed unchallenged political and military supremacy, but its domination of the world was incomplete, even fragile. The reason for this is given in Milton's line from Paradise Lost, "Who overcomes by force hath overcome but half his foe." Even if some aspects of Western civilization were welcomed by the native peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, by and large Western domination was the product of conquest and military superiority. The British, for example, governed India with the police power of 100,000 troops. The rulers were able to secure the conformity, but not the support, of the native peoples. Eventually, native leaders emerged who resolved to fight and uproot European rule from their soil. The Europeans saw this happening, and therefore the mood at the dawn of the 20th century was somber. Intelligent Europeans knew that there was a good chance that the whole colonial enterprise might fall apart. So it did. The 20th century witnessed the rise of liberation movements throughout Asia, Africa, and South America in resistance to colonialism and Western domination. Within the West, civil rights movements led by black and brown people demanded the extension of full citizenship and equal rights to minorities that had previously been excluded and discriminated against. These movements met with resistance, political as well as military. In some places, the natives fought guerrilla wars against the colonial powers. But ultimately, the non-white peoples of the world prevailed. They did not secure their freedom by inflicting a military defeat on the West. This they did not have the power to do. They won by appealing to the principles of the West, including the principle of self-determination, and by shaming the West into relinquishing its empire and granting independence to its former colonies. One of my high school teachers in India liked to say, "If Hitler had been ruling India, Gandhi would be a lampshade." This man was not known for his sensitivity, but he had a habit of speaking the truth. His point was that the success of Gandhi and of the Indian protesters who prostrated themselves on the train tracks depended on the certain knowledge that the trains would stop rather than run over them. With tactics such as these, Gandhi and his followers hoped to paralyze British rule in India, and they succeeded. But what if the British had ordered the trains to keep going? This is certainly what Hitler would have done. I don't see Genghis Khan or Attila the Hun being deterred by Gandhi's strategies. Even as the Indians denounced the West as wholly unprincipled and immoral, they relied on Western principles and Western morality to secure their independence. One by one, the nations of South America, Asia, and Africa won their freedom. Indeed, anti-colonialism was the dominant political trajectory of much of the 20th century. By the middle of the century, so rapid was the momentum of anti-colonialism that it seemed to imperil the confidence, perhaps even the identity, of Western civilization. A deep pessimism descended on many in the West.